We're going to wait for questions until the end of the session. I would like to introduce Dr. Anna Novak. She is a medical oncology and a member of the Perth Mesothelioma Center. And she has been a major force and participated in mesothelioma research over the past 10 years. She has been active in preclinical research. Her laboratory work in mesothelioma at the University of Western Australia includes her PhD thesis on combination of chemoimmunotherapy in murine model. And this work was awarded local, national, and international level recognition. She won International Mesothelioma Interest Group New Investigator Award in 2002. More recently, she has continued to investigate the role of PET scanning in prognostication and monitoring of treatment response in mesothelioma, and is the principal investigator of the investigator-initiated phase two clinical trial of sunitinib as a second-line treatment in mesothelioma. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm just going to work out how to use this. Okay, it's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation. You may be wondering why somebody from the most isolated capital city in the world has been asked to come and speak at a mesothelioma forum. Oops, those were my disclosures. But I work in Perth, where's the pointer on this? Beg your pardon, there's two. Okay, thank you. I work in Perth, which is this yellow dot down at the bottom of Western Australia. And we have a catchment area of around 2.5 million people, which is really not that many in comparison to many of the cities in the US. However, what we do have is a high incidence of mesothelioma. And this is a map of mineral mines and mineral deposits. And up here in the northwest of Australia is the Kimberley, with rich mineral deposits, including of chrysidolite asbestos, the most carcinogenic form of asbestos. So because it's so inhospitable up here, people generally didn't live there. They passed through for jobs. People coming as new immigrants to Australia worked in the mine and mill in Wittenoom. And now these people all live close to Perth and have a particularly high incidence of mesothelioma. So we have about 100 patients a year in our city and 1,000 patients a year in Australia with mesothelioma. It's an area of spectacular natural beauty, red gorges, seasonal rivers, but Wittenoom, where that chrysidolite asbestos was mined, not only had a mine and a mill that affected the workers, but unfortunately they also used the asbestos tailings in schoolyards, sand pits, and the racetrack, meaning that the whole population was heavily exposed. So now I commonly see the children of people who lived and worked in Wittenoom, and they may have only been there for a small number of months or years. So I've been tasked to talk about anti-angiogenics in mesothelioma, and angiogenesis is one piece of the jigsaw puzzle, one of the hallmarks of cancer. But it turns out that it is now important in mesothelioma because of two recent clinical trials, both of which have been positive and may be moving towards changing our standard of care. Now, this is a timeline of first-line treatment in this disease. So my mentor and colleague, Michael Byrne, published in 1999 a combination of cisplatin and gemcitabine, which first made people sit up and take notice that chemotherapy could be effective in mesothelioma. That was quickly eclipsed by the randomised phase 3 study by Vogelzang in 2003, and the addition of raltatrexed to cisplatin didn't really change what we did clinically. Cisplatin and pemetrexed became our de facto standard. And we've had to wait 12 years before we've had another positive chemotherapy clinical trial in this disease, which is cisplatin, pemetrexed and bevacizumab, the MAPS trial. So why is angiogenesis important in mesothelioma? Well, it appears to highly express VEGF-A, VEGF-C, and the VEGF receptor. And VEGF may be an autocrine growth factor in this disease. High tissue VEGF expression might be an independent poor prognostic factor in this disease, and that's been shown by a number of authors. And if you have a high serum concentration of VEGF or a lot of VEGF in your pleural fluid, that's probably also a negative prognostic indicator. So, whoops, sorry for pointing at the audience. We have images of disordered, chaotic blood vessels in a murine tumour, as opposed to a normal orderly vasculature. And where this becomes important is that the anti-angiogenics can normalise those disordered chaotic blood vessels more towards a normal vasculature. And we see a number of benefits here. The increased vascular permeability, which is leaky, will decrease. The interstitial fluid pressure will decrease, which may allow drugs to permeate the tumour better. Edema and swelling of the tumour will decrease. We may also have improved perfusion and oxygenation of the tumour. Cancer cell shedding, invasiveness and metastasis, while less important in a local disease like mesothelioma, may also reduce. And interestingly, the sensitivity to radiotherapy, anti-cancer drugs, as well as the immune response, can all increase once we normalise angiogenesis. However, it's probably finely balanced, because whilst we can go from abnormal vasculature to a normalised vasculature, that normalisation window can close and we can get excessive pruning of the vasculature, which may lead to necrosis and cell death rather than the normalisation of vessels. And it can also, of course, return to an abnormal vasculature. So there's a lot of different anti-angiogenics that are available and in trials at the moment and over the last few years. Monoclonal antibodies, particularly bevacizumab, which targets VEGF-A, the main one I'm going to talk about today, together with nintedanib and other tyrosine kinase inhibitors. But we also have vascular disrupting agents, including BNC105P, a trial that I led in Australia, which was a negative clinical trial. We've got peptide inhibitors such as endostatin, and potentially metronomic chemotherapy, low-dose continuous chemotherapy, which has been proposed as targeting endothelial cells and as an anti-angiogenic. So we've spent a lot of time, particularly around 10 years ago, looking at angiogenesis or anti-angiogenics in mesothelioma. And this is a partial list, mostly of tyrosine kinase inhibitors that have been studied. And you'll see from the A's and B's up here that most of them have been single agent, single arm clinical trials. Some of those combined with pemetrexed and cisplatin. But we've got very few that have been put to the ultimate test of a randomised clinical trial. And partly that's because the single arm, single agent clinical trials didn't show us a good signal for any activity of these agents on their own. So this busy slide, the most important column is probably this one showing the fairly low response rates, mostly below 10%, which didn't generate enough further interest from the pharmaceutical companies sponsoring these trials to go on and look further in this disease. But you'll note that most of these clinical trials were fairly small patient numbers, around 50 at the most. We can also see what happens to the progression-free survival of mesothelioma when we have a truly inactive agent, and that's around 1.5 months. So in mesothelioma, I'm going to focus on bevacizumab, which is the anti-VEGF antibody, and tyrosine kinase inhibitors, which stop the downstream signalling from dimerization of the VEGF receptor on ligating with VEGF. But also the tyrosine kinase inhibitors can affect some other signalling molecules such as platelet-derived growth factor, PDGFR, and fibroblast growth factor receptor. So the history of bevacizumab in mesothelioma. We've got three main clinical trials, which were phase two, either single agent or one randomised phase two trial. This one showed a 34% response rate for pemetrexed and carboplatin with bevacizumab, and then a 40% response rate for another single agent with pemetrexed and, combination with pemetrexed and cisplatin. Now, these were single-arm studies, and the partial and complete response rates didn't look that much better than chemotherapy. But the median survival for these patients did look longer than with chemotherapy alone, at least from the Vogel-Zhang study. So a randomised phase two trial, the first one with cisplatin and gemcitabine, was performed, but unfortunately did not show any benefit of the addition of bevacizumab to chemotherapy. And this is the overall survival curve from that study. We had to wait quite a long time until the combination of cisplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab in the MAPS trial came out. This was a long-awaited study and reported first at ASCO in 2015 by Gerard Zaltzman. The design of the study had cisplatin and pemetrexed for six cycles, which is relatively standard, followed by surveillance and not a matched placebo. And I think this is really important because knowing whether your patient is on active therapy or not has the potential to bias investigator review of progression and response, because we are all human and we want our new treatments to work. The intervention arm added bevacizumab 15 milligrams per kilogram on the first day of every cycle, and then patients had maintenance bevacizumab after their chemotherapy was completed. Patients were allowed to have a performance status of 0 to 2, so including some people who may not have been so well. And this is the overall survival curve from the MAPS study. There is a relatively small difference between these arms, but a hazard ratio of 0.77, which was modestly statistically significant. And of note, there were over 400 patients in this trial. But when we get down to the end of the curve, we really have very, very few patients that we're looking at here, just 8 and 7. So I don't think we can make anything much of the separation of the curves at the end. Progression-free survival showed a hazard ratio of 0.61. And again, some patients remaining on study and progression-free up to around 20 months, but very few remaining on treatment for longer than that. The next study I'm going to talk about is the LUM-MESO study, which uses nintedanib. This is an oral multikinase inhibitor targeting not only VEGF receptors 1 to 3, but also PDGF receptors, FGF receptors, and SRC and ABL kinase. The reason that's important is that it not only strongly inhibits mesothelioma tumour growth in human xenograft models, that is, models that are vascularised, but it also reduces colony-forming capacity and migration in mesothelioma cell lines. In other words, in an experimental model in which the vasculature is not important. So it may actually have some anti-tumour effect. Combined with other chemotherapies, it's been manageable for safety. So the study design, this was what I presented at ASCO this year, was patients with unresectable mesothelioma, epithelioid or biphasic only, ECOG performance status 0 to 1. Patients were randomised to receive chemotherapy with either nintedanib twice daily, taken orally, or with a matched placebo. What we see here, and remembering that this is actually a very small number of patients, it's a randomised phase 2 study, just 87 patients, is that the median survival for the nintedanib arm was 9.4 months, and for the placebo arm, 5.7 months, with a hazard ratio of 0.54. And for overall survival, 14.2 increasing to 18.3 months, with a hazard ratio of 0.77, which was not statistically significant. The study was not powered to look at overall survival. It was a phase 2 study. So down to the nitty-gritty of who benefits from adding angiogenics, anti-angiogenics to chemotherapy. Are there known clinical indicators of benefit? Do we have biomarkers? Or are we just stuck with picking those patients who have a contraindication to anti-angiogenics? And please note that none of these treatments are FDA approved, so I'm talking about off-label treatment here. So when we look at the subgroup analysis from the MAPS clinical trial of bevacizumab, we see that most of these are cross-unity, suggesting that there is no differential benefit for any particular group. Surprisingly, ECOG performance status 2 did better, but these are tiny patient numbers, so I don't think that we can read anything into that. And it's also counterintuitive when we also see that those with a good hemoglobin level may have done a little better. So those two indicators are probably opposite ends of the spectrum for patient clinical indicators. Similarly, with the LUM-MESO study, nintedanib, we really don't have any strong indicators of who might have done better. Biphasic is to the other side of the line, suggesting that they may not have done so well, but again, tiny patient numbers, just 10 patients. And although the study and the company has moved forward with looking at epithelioid only, I really don't think that this was warranted on the data that we have. However, they have reported the results from epithelioid patients alone showing a better hazard ratio of 0.49, statistically significant for progression-free survival, and overall survival also improved at 0.7 for the hazard ratio. So who should and should not receive anti-angiogenics? Well, one could say no one, because none of these are FDA approved. However, some people will be using these drugs, particularly bevacizumab, and I think it's very much premature to consider using nintedanib on the basis of phase 2 data. Patients do need to have good performance status and no contraindications to anti-angiogenics, and I think that's really what it comes down to at the moment. So we need to be choosing patients who are not fully anticoagulated, do not have contraindications such as cardiac comorbidities or uncontrolled hypertension, have not recently had major surgery and are not planned for major surgery, do not have open wounds, or are not at risk of gastrointestinal perforation and have active GI, other GI disease. Where it's unclear is in the different histologies, although the bevacizumab data lent towards sarcomatoid benefiting, the nintedanib data lent towards epithelioid benefiting, I don't think that we can say anything about these on the very small patient numbers that were in those subgroup analyses. We don't know about the use of carboplatin and pemetrexed with bevacizumab. And in peritoneal mesothelioma, I would have significant concerns given that many of these patients have aggressive surgery and may potentially be at higher risk of gastrointestinal perforation, which is devastating and can be fatal. So what about biomarkers? Can these solve the problem? Unfortunately, probably not. In every tumour type in which there has been a search for biomarkers of efficacy of bevacizumab, there have been conflicting results. These lists of potential baseline predictors have come up: VEGF-A, short VEGF isoforms, serum VEGF, circulating VEGF receptor, angiopoietin 2 and IL-8. But in every clinical trial that you look at, or in every disease you look at, there'll be one clinical trial that says, yes, this is a predictor. There'll be another that says, no, this is not a predictor. in the tumour, CD31 positive tumour vessel density or presence of fibroblasts and myeloid-derived suppressor cells, again, conflicting. And even genetic susceptibility, looking at single nucleotide polymorphisms for the VEGF isoforms and VEGF receptors, these have not been conclusive. Those were predictors of efficacy at baseline. We can also look at candidates of biomarkers of on-treatment change. What happens between baseline and a second or third or subsequent cycle that might tell us whether this patient is going to respond or is responding to treatment? Well, unfortunately, we have very much the same problem with a replication crisis, a whole lot of potential candidates, including some interesting ones in some cancers, such as circulating endothelial cells, vessel architecture imaging or DCE MRI scans, and even the development of hypertension and proteinuria, although notably it's those patients who stay on therapy for longer that develop hypertension and proteinuria anyway. So this may be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So in all of these trials, mesothelioma and non-mesothelioma, there's a replication crisis. Many of these studies have tested multiple potential biomarkers with the potential to have false positives due to multiple testing. So in mesothelioma, we have conflicting information. The NVALT5 thalidomide study that I haven't talked about may have favoured those with raised IL-6 and non-epithelioid histology. NGR015, perhaps those with more aggressive disease and a shorter treatment-free interval. The cisplatin, gemcitabine and bevacizumab, those with lower serum VEGF levels. These data have not been reported from the MAPS study. And the LUM-MESO study, I can tell you a little bit because the World Lung Cancer abstracts have just been released on Friday. So I'm able to tell you the content of the abstract. This is from Dr. Kindler's cisplatin, gemcitabine, bevacizumab study. What you can see here is that when the patients are divided into groups with the serum VEGF-A above the median and below the median, this is a prognostic indicator. People with less circulating VEGF-A do better than those with more circulating VEGF-A. And here, the blue line shows those which received bevacizumab as well as chemotherapy, and the red lines those who had chemotherapy only. And if your VEGF-A level was low, then you appeared to benefit more from bevacizumab. If your VEGF level was higher, you appeared not to benefit from bevacizumab. The hypothesis here may be that if you haven't got a lot of circulating VEGF-A, then maybe you have more opportunity to saturate capture of VEGF-A with bevacizumab and have a beneficial effect. So in the LUM-MESO study, these are data that I'll be presenting in more detail at World Lung in a week and a half's time. Blood was collected at baseline monotherapy cycle 3 and at the end of the monotherapy treatment, so when patients failed treatment. Again, we see the potential for false positives due to multiple testing. A human angiogenesis panel was used that looked at 58 putative angiogenic factors and also single nucleotide polymorphisms in a number of VEGF genes were examined. These associations of biomarkers with treatment were evaluated by Cox regression, although there was a false discovery rate adjustment. Now, I'm not able to tell you anything more than what is in the abstract, including the direction of any changes, but they looked at epithelioid tumours only. Angiogenic factors were available for 71 patients and genomic data for 67 patients. There was a weak signal which was not statistically significant for baseline plasma endoglin and weak associations between major homozygous genotypes for three VEGF SNPs, two with overall survival and one with progression-free survival, but they were not the same. So what this has done, well, what it hasn't done is solved the problem. What it has done is narrowed down the search a little for evaluation in the phase three study. So hopefully the phase three study will not make the mistake of multiple testing with the potential for false positives. So what are the next frontiers in anti-angiogenesis in mesothelioma? Well, there is a lot of redundancy and crosstalk in angiogenesis, like with every molecular pathway that we have ever studied in cancer. If you manage to block the VEGF receptor, something else is going to come along and take its place. If you use a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and you block not only the VEGF receptor, but also a range of other receptors, we may be a little better off, we don't know yet, pending the results of randomised phase three clinical trials. But we're still probably not going to solve the problem of angiogenesis in cancer with one drug. We don't even know the mechanism of benefit in mesothelioma. Are we actually normalising the vasculature? And by normalising the vasculature, allowing increased perfusion of our chemotherapy drugs and decreased hypoxia, allowing the treatment that we know works to work better and to work in more patients. If so, what is the role of maintenance bevacizumab or maintenance nintedanib after chemotherapy? And we don't know that because the right studies haven't been done. And what happens when angiogenesis becomes abnormal again? What happens if we give our drug for too long or we give too much of it and we have excessive pruning and hypoxia from anti-angiogenic treatment? It's going to be difficult to optimise the benefits of anti-angiogenics in mesothelioma, and this is the same problem that we have in this disease with every treatment modality. Because we don't have enough patients to juggle around our dose, our schedule, how we integrate with chemotherapy in trials that are going to subtly enhance our therapy, perhaps, but not lead to a paradigm shift in what we're doing. We're really looking for paradigm shifts in mesothelioma. In breast cancer, there are so many patients that we can juggle how many cycles of treatment we give or what doses we give. Can we optimise those treatment parameters? Well, perhaps we can learn from either mouse models or from looking at other cancers and choose and be very selective about the future clinical trials that we do. Combining anti-angiogenesis with immunotherapy may be a fertile way forward. Not only does tumour oxygenation and perfusion improve when we normalise the vasculature, but we also increase the influx of immune effector cells and decrease some of the suppressive subgroups, such as myeloid-derived suppressor cells. We may also skew towards a more Th1 rather than Th2, so an appropriate anti-tumour immune environment. Anti-angiogenics can also suppress the number and function of regulatory T cells, some of our key negative regulators, as well as myeloid-derived suppressor cells. Just want to finish by touching on some of the upcoming clinical trials of angiogenesis or anti-angiogenesis in mesothelioma. The EORTC NEMO study may help us tease out whether maintenance anti-angiogenics are important, although bearing in mind that nintedanib may have some anti-tumour activities as well as pure anti-angiogenic activity. So this is a double-blinded phase two trial, randomising patients who have completed chemotherapy to either nintedanib or placebo. We also have a trial at the Barbara Ann Karmanos Cancer Institute of nintedanib in recurrent malignant pleural mesothelioma, and Anne Sauer's SWOG trial of pemetrexed and cisplatin with or without cediranib in people with mesothelioma. Again, none of these are going to lead to a paradigm shift. This is the schema for the SWOG trial. Interestingly, early results presented in 2013 at ASCO showed results that may be well aligned with those of the bevacizumab trial and the nintedanib trial. And the ongoing LUM-MESO phase 3 trial has a very similar design to the LUM-MESO phase 2 trial. The key differences are that this is only recruiting patients with epithelioid mesothelioma, which I may add is a commercial decision to fast track approval of this drug and does not necessarily mean that the agent is not going to be useful in sarcomatoid or biphasic. And the other difference being the numbers, 450 patients, and it's about two-thirds recruited at the moment. So moving forward, do we need to integrate bevacizumab into new phase 3 trials in mesothelioma? Well, none of the current phase 3 trials incorporate bevacizumab. Bevacizumab is not going to be FDA approved for this indication because the MAPS trial was not a regulatory trial. Much as Roche has gone back and tried to look at whether it was done to regulatory standards. If the VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitor trials are positive, what then? Are we ever going to compare bevacizumab and other anti-angiogenics, or are we just going to move on? I suspect we may just move on because of the ease of administration of oral agents as well as the good toxicity profile. We're really not sure yet how we can optimise use of these agents, and we're going to need to ask the hard questions about rationally combining them with immunotherapy and other agents. Thank you for your attention, and this is the team at the National Centre for Asbestos-Related Diseases within which I work.